Today we cover Hinduism. We start it, at least, cover Hinduism. You couldn't do that in one entire day. But we're going to cover our introduction. And I remind you of the schema that I had introduced last time, in which the ultimate Hindu view, the one that's going to develop as we trace that, is that everything is divine. The divine encompasses all things. And the world that we experience of things that are not divine, because they come in being and pass away, they change, and so on. That's the world of our experience, and that's called Maya, the illusion, because it makes us think, leads us to think that this is what is real and this is all there is, when in fact the being of these things is not like them. The being of all these things is Brahmanatman, the divine. It is not a thing, but the being that is in everything, the beingness. Now, Hinduism, of course, arose in India, and it arose out of religious traditions that are older and that were very dualistic and did not at all subscribe to this schema. The pagan religions that were already there were ones that had gods of the earth and the sky and the storms and the usual panoply of concentrations of the divine in gods. And it was centered around an idea of sin, of misdeeds. How do I make up for my misdeeds? How is it that the divine will not hold me responsible or punish me for things I've done wrong? And so there arose in this pagan religion a priesthood, a group of people devoted to interceding between you and the divine, between the average Joe and the divine for forgiveness of sin. And the priests there had a practice of drinking what they called soma. It's an alcoholic beverage. And they would sit around and they would get high on this, and they would have hallucinations and go into trances and come out with information about the divine. They believed strongly in magic, in what I explained last time as kind of that leftover divinity that's free-floating and not concentrated in this god or that, and that the priests knew the mantras, which were the formulas for getting hold of that magic and making it work for them. So they had a system of sacrifices. What do you do? If you've done something wrong, you go to the priest, you tell him, you give him so much money, you could get a sacrifice together, and you make the sacrifice, and the priest intercedes for you and prays for you and so on. But it expanded into more than that. Because the priests were viewed as having had access to the divine and to this leftover divine power, they could do you big favors. There was an old saying in India that because the priests had access to the gods, the priests were gods. I mean, that's who you have to curry favor with. And so what arose was an elaborate practice of sacrifice in which people could come and ask for things they really wanted. Say to the priest, make her fall in love with me. I need a really good crop this year. I'm trying to work this business deal. Make it work out for me. Whatever. Until you, these sacrifices were arranged in a kind of hierarchical order so that you could, if you did the last one, the greatest one, you were guaranteed to get what you want. Guaranteed. It required the slaughter of 400 horses. And then, of course, if you slaughtered the 400 horses, you were wealthy enough to be able to do that, and you paid off the priests, and you didn't get what you wanted, they saw, oh, we must have done something wrong somewhere, off to do it again. Well, that's the kind of thing that was going on there. But there was also reflection on religion, reflection on the divine, on the relation to the divine, going on among the priests. And they began to write hymns called Vedas. Some of them go back a long way. Some people think as far as 1,500 years before Christ. But anyway, in these writings, these hymns, we get more and more theological thinking reflected, till finally we come to a famous one called the Rig Veda. And in the 129th hymn of Book 10, we get this, and it's a remarkable change and development in the theology. Then there was neither being nor non-being. There was no air, no firmament beyond it. Was there a stirring? Where? Beneath what cover? Was there a great abyss of unplumbed water? The assumed answer to all those questions is no, there's nothing else. There was no death nor anything immortal, nor any sign dividing night from day. That one thing, breathing no air, was yet self-breathing. See, it's the one thing, the one reality, is self-sufficient. No second thing existed whatsoever. Darkness was hidden in deeper darkness, and all was as a sea without dimensions. The void still held unformed what was potential until the power of warmth produced a soul one. Then, in that one, desire stirred into being. Desire that was the earliest seed of spirit. Stretching their line across the void, they pondered, was aught above it, aught below it? Bestowers of the seed were there, and powers, free energy below, and above swift action. Who truly knows, and who can explain it? Whence it was born, or how this world was fashioned? The gods came later than the earth's creation. Who knows, then, out of what the world issued? Whether the world was made or self-made, he knows with full assurance, he alone, who in the highest heaven guards and watches. He knows indeed, but then, again, perhaps he doesn't. It's a remarkable passage because it's a transition from seeing forces in the earth or in within the world as divine to a divine that's in back of everything, and there is only one. And it existed when there was nothing else. The line is, no second thing existed whatsoever. And because of that, there's an implied pantheism. If it's the only reality, then what is this world going to be made out of? It's going to be made out of the being of that divine reality. And that's the schema we have here. The non-divine is made out of whatever this is. This is being itself, and that is being itself disguised as transient, different beings, beings with differences of quality, quantity, place, time, and so on, all of that being illusory because it's all going to go away and be reabsorbed into the divine. Well, after the Vedas, there were commentaries on them. And this is more theological yet. These commentaries were called Upanishads. And in that we get the development of what now is Hinduism proper. The Vedas were finished about 300 years before Christ. And the Upanishads took over, began to be written. And there's a lot of theological reflection. The Rig Veda is remarkable standout among the Vedas, but the Upanishads regularly do this kind of stuff. Let's get some terms down here so that we don't confuse ourselves as we go along. The term Brahma originally meant a prayer. And the divine then became called, came to be called Brahman Atman. Now sometimes Hindus speak just of Brahman and just of Atman. And I explained this before. Brahman is the divine as it's in everything else, and Atman is the divine in the human self. So sometimes if you just want to talk about humans, you talk about Atman. If you just want to talk about the divine as it exists in all the rest of nature, it's Brahman. All that is not to be confused with... All I have to do is mess this up and you be confused about exactly what I'm trying not to confuse you with. A Brahmin is a priest. Brahman is the divine. Brahma is a prayer, originally, and it gets a second use, you'll see in a moment. And then there are three main Hindu gods that are thought of as embodying Brahman Atman or conveying Brahman Atman to the average person. And one of them is Brahma, again, with just the A on the end, creator, and Shiva, destroyer. So this word appears again in a second use. And then there are these three gods. Vishnu, of course, is the preserver. Now, as this pantheistic theology is developed, the priests are going to take the position that Brahman Atman, the unknowable being itself, is the real divinity. When people worship local gods in their villages, or when they rise to something higher than that, and they think of the creator, preserver, and destroyer in these three representations, it's still, the truth is, there's only Brahman Atman. So for a Brahmin priest, these are myths. And they are no more literally true than, or is it true that this local village has this god over here and that local village has that god over there and so on. But in Hinduism, the priests, the Brahmin priests, take a very benign and easy view of these other religious practices. Why? Well, because they believe, as is part of the theology here, that people are born and reborn and reborn and reborn. And that wheel of rebirth is called samsara. And since we are all in that wheel of rebirth, people come back with better abilities than they had in their previous life. If someone's given the spiritual insight to see the truth of this basic pantheistic schema, that this is unthinkable, unknowable, unspeakable, and it's really all there is, and the rest of us are all really already parts of it, if we can detach ourselves from our troubles with this world, which is only an illusion anyway, then we can escape samsara. Moksha is the deliverance. And we can be absorbed back into it, which is nirvana. So the priest has the idea that if the person is worshiping the local village god, that's the best insight they have in this life. In the next life, they may have more. So encourage the guy. Go give your blessing, participate in it, encourage people, because then they'll have more insight in their next life. Maybe they'll rise to these three, and maybe in another lifetime they'll be reborn as a Brahmin priest and know the real truth. And that brings me to another point, that all of this is mightily tied up with what we call the caste system. Somewhere around 1500 BC, India was invaded by Aryans from the north. And it was a migration. You know, I say invaded because sometimes it was violent and they repressed the people that were already there. But it wasn't an invasion that took months to do or something. It was many, many years of migrating down the Indian subcontinent from the west. And what arose was a system in which people considered themselves better than others just by what the family they had been born into. The people that they repressed, the Dravidians, were the lowest of the castes and were considered, and later came to be called, untouchables. You don't even touch this person. You don't talk to them. You don't deal with them. They're beneath you. And the castes went all the way up in a hierarchy until you came to the Maharaja, the king, and the priest. And it was in question for a while whether the priest or the Maharaja would be at the top. But you know how that came out. It's the Brahmin priests that are at the top of the caste system. And so as I was explaining the typical Brahmin priest attitude toward this other sort of folk religion, it was one of benign acceptance and encouragement, because that person is probably not going to have the insight to be able to believe this until they're reborn a Brahmin. The caste system regarded the Dravidian as the lowest. They're the untouchables. But lower than that was to be born a woman. A woman waits only to be reborn as a man, even an untouchable. And then people will, by their good works and their devotion and their insight, they will be raised in successive rebirths to higher and higher castes. Until finally, when you're reborn as a Brahmin, you know then that this is the last lifetime. You're not going to be reborn again by samsara. You're going to now be reabsorbed. You're going to make it to nirvana. The idea of nirvana is an interesting one. It comes from a term, the root of which means to blow out a candle, to be snuffed. And originally, that's what Hinduism promised. It promised deliverance from this life, deliverance from pain and suffering by being snuffed out. Hinduism, of course, is very adaptable. And it eventually that became not just annihilation, but a life of bliss. Still, in nirvana, the individual is reabsorbed like a drop of water is reabsorbed in the ocean. In other words, you as an individual don't exist anymore. And they try to say that this is a life of complete bliss. That especially happened after contact with Christianity and Islam. Because Christianity and Islam were talking about a heavenly life, an eternal life with God, in which you survive. You are resurrected. You go to be with the Lord forever. And that sounded a lot better than being snuffed out by being absorbed like a drop into the ocean. So this developed into, oh no, it means a life of bliss and happiness. It's difficult to understand how you could have a life of bliss and happiness if you, the individual, is gone. Well, that's where it stands. I said that I would be critical, and I will be, and of Christianity as well when we get there. So here are some basic terms. Here's the basic schema. You get the theological lay of the land here. Let's make sure that this is all clear. Brahmanatman is the divine. It's not a being. It's not a person. It's not someone you. It's not a person. You can't pray to Brahmanatman. Brahmanatman doesn't hear prayers or grant and requests. You understand? This is just being itself, the being that is in everything. And for reasons we don't understand, it has somehow generated within itself this world of illusory Maya. Hinduism contains the doctrine that every so many hundred million years, Brahmanatman destroys the world of illusion and makes a new one, generates a new one within it. This is what we would call the observable universe. It's where we live and move and have our being, but everything that we experience comes into being and passes away. We don't encounter anything that could just last forever or be completely non-dependent. And yet something's got to be non-dependent. So they're saying this exists within the non-dependent. In one sense, the being of Brahmanatman is what this illusory world is made of. But what gets made in it are these come into being and pass away transient things like galaxies, planets, like the ocean, people, continents. Everything comes into being and passes away and changes all the while it's there. That's how you know it's not the divine. A Brahma was originally a prayer, but later became one of the three big gods of Hinduism. If you've got to believe in gods, you can graduate from the lower ones in the villages to the three great creator, destroyer, preserver. But these are, again, just mythological representations of the force of Brahmanatman. Brahmanatman is the divine, a Brahmin is a priest. Samsara is the wheel, a cycle of rebirth. And that is driven by fate. There's one in the same time. The idea that humans are responsible for what they do, so Hinduism condemns evil. You don't murder people, you shouldn't rob them and lie to them and so on. The same moral insights that you find all over the world. But you're fated to be reborn as this or that or the other thing. It's a funny combination, because if you really have the free will to make the choices you do, then you're responsible for what you do. If you don't have it, if fate drives you, makes you do something whether you want to or not, then how can you be punished or rewarded for what you do? It wasn't you that made the decision. It was driven by fate. But that they combine these, and without resolving them. I think by comparison, Christianity teaches that people absolutely do have free will and are responsible for what they, for their choices and their actions. Moksha is the term for the deliverance from that cycle of rebirth. That happens by being enlightened, and we'll talk about that in the next session, how one gets to be enlightened and therefore escape from that wheel of rebirth. And nirvana is what happens to you if you are. It's what you're state of being becomes. If you do escape from samsara, then you're reabsorbed into Brahmanatman. That's the state of nirvana. And the expression is as a drop of water is absorbed into the ocean. And there you have the basic background, the what's wrong with people, how it's going to be solved, their ultimate fate against this theological arrangement and this of this religious belief. The doctrine of samsara also includes that if you're wicked, you can be reborn further down the chain of beings. So it's possible that if you're wicked enough, you can, in the next life, you'll be reborn as a jackal. They consider jackals dirty animals, and that would be a punishment. Or maybe even an insect. Or, I mean, there's almost no limit there to what might happen to you. And, of course, because all this is tied in with the caste system, they believe the main body of Hindu thinkers has always held that you have to be reborn up the castes, and it's only when you get to be a Brahmin that you can expect not to be reborn and to escape samsara and be and achieve nirvana. Some have relented a bit and said that now it's possible for somebody to get enlightenment at a lower level and perhaps make it to nirvana, but it's not open to any woman. That's too low on the scale of beings. That's the scale of humans is higher than any animal, but the lowest step on the scale of humans is woman, then untouchable, and then on up to Maharaja, and then Brahmin priest. The Brahmin caste can be recognized in India. There are certain family names that automatically tell them what caste someone belongs to, and that the Brahmin caste is readily recognizable and has produced a remarkable number of brilliant people, scientists, poets, writers of all kinds. So it just helps to reinforce the notion that that it's a superior class, caste. When the British ruled India under the Raj in the 19th century, they tried to get the practice of widows throwing themselves on the pyre of their husband's body being burned. They tried to repress that. They said, you can't do that anymore. And they repressed a lot of it, but not all of it. And since India's independence, some of it has resurged. That's one of the nastier things. Since the wife is at the lowest, below all the castes, in the lowest stage of being reborn, she can do one final act of devotion to her husband and throw herself on the pyre that's burning his body, since he has died, and she commits suicide and therefore will be reborn as a man. We'll go into that some more next time when we talk about the specific recommendations for how people should stand in proper relation to the divine and achieve nirvana. And we'll talk next time about the stages of life and the goals of life and the ways to achieve nirvana and so on. So what I want you to do is do the reading for next time. Do the reading for this one, do the reading for the next one, right? You were supposed to have done the reading already for this one. Then it's reading, lecture, reading. So you want to read the stuff for this one again, then you want to read the introduction for the next one, then we'll have the lecture, and then you read that again, right? You remember what I hope you remember. And do that, and I think we'll be fine. So, but we'll see you next time.